Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is TS Radio Network. Our show tonight is Whistleblowers, and we have a very special guest. She's been on another show with us, and this is Gretchen Rachel Hammond, and she has been doing an extensive investigation in Michigan, most particularly in the Detroit area, on the abuses of probate, what happens to people when they go in, who's involved, who did it, and who got it. This has at times been a dangerous situation for her. She stuck to it right to the end and is in the process now of getting this whole report together for publishing. So please help me welcome Gretchen Rachel Hammond to the show. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi. Thank you, Marty. How are you?
Yeah, just old and cold. sitting up here in Minnesota. You know, it just... is one of those times. Gretchen, you've really been through an ordeal here with this whole thing, this whole investigation. As you got into it, were you surprised at what you found?
Yeah, very. I mean, you always, I mean, you know, I was remembering back to, you know, when I wrote the first story about this, which was the case of Mimi Brun, who was, a Detroit area woman whose then 92-year-old mother was placed under guardianship at the Oakland County Probate Court over a past due bill of $32,000.
Okay.
And I thought it was a fascinating case back then because of the various aspects to it. You know, Brun's durable power of attorney with her mother had been just summarily tossed out for no reason. There was no medical evidence given at the hearing. And again, you know, I didn't find anything under the Michigan Estates and Protected Individuals Code, or EPIC,
right,
which allowed for a guardian and conservator to be used as a bill collector or as a collection agency.
Yes.
So after that story was published, I got calls from across Oakland County from different families, actually other counties as well, Wayne, Washtenaw, and it led me to believe that there was a systemic problem, possibly, at the Oakland County Probate Court. So, you know, against the advice of everyone from my mom to, you know, friends in the journalism community, I launched this sort of investigation, you know, just on that hunch. And, you know, you always go in feeling, you know, with a sort of assumption of innocence. You know, you're just going to go into what the evidence bears out. And as myself and then, you know, I had a team of three researchers from Wayne State. And then, you know, I was joined by a couple of CPAs. And as we started reviewing, you know, well over 2,278 different accounts belonging to four public administrators at the Oakland County Probate Court, we began to very, very quickly see a pattern and practice via which, you know, we were seeing petitions that were filed by APS for no apparent, for really reasons that just staggered us. Bipolar, may have dementia, fell down at the parking lot of Costco. A lot of petitions, you know, from nursing homes demanding payment. Or Medicaid applications. And, you know, so we saw that, and then we saw evidence of guardian ad litems who were, you know, not really fulfilling their duties and, you know, doing a full investigation and talking to the wards themselves. And then actually what we began to discover was that the guardian ad litems, you know, some of them, not all, were, you know, actively sort of encouraging the ward to accept a public administrator as a guardian and conservator. And just so your listeners know, a public administrator in Michigan is someone appointed by the state attorney general, the state public administrator. But their job description is really not to be a guardian and conservator. The job description is to handle probate cases on deceased estates where there are no living heirs. But, you know, organizations, you know, probate courts like the Oakland County Probate Court use them as guardian and conservator. Although apparently they do so just as private attorneys and not as public administrators. The confusing thing for families is that, you know, whenever a court appoints one of these individuals, the judge always says, well, we're appointing a public administrator. So these families believe that, you know, they're doing their jobs as a public administrator. So when, you know, a lot of problems have occurred, they've gone to state public administrator Michael Moody and they've been sent packing. And the excuse that I have been given is that Mr. Moody is not, his purview does not include what they do as guardians and conservators. That's not something he can control. So, you know, so it's really the families have no recourse. And, you know, as we, you know, continued our investigation, we found so many disturbing things. You know, individuals moved out of homes 99% of the time within a month of guardianship or conservatorship being initiated, and they were sent to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and a lot of unlicensed group homes that we found. And we went over Thanksgiving weekend to visit them, and we found, you know, well over half of them to be unstaffed.
Yes.
When we went, and some of the living conditions were just subhuman. So, you know, as it all sort of played out, and, you know, then I started getting threats and this, that, and the other, which was really unusual because, you know, I've done investigations into ICE facilities and the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, and never have I ever felt like, you know, life or liberty was in danger until I started looking into this probate court. And then, you know, things just got worse and worse and worse the longer I stayed. And, you know, they seemed to get a little bit more vitriolic, or the judges did. You know, I had one judge mention me on the record about, you know, making sure that, you know, accounts didn't get into the wrong hands, i.e. my hands.
Yes.
You know, so, I mean, you know, it was just, and then, of course, being strip searched by the sheriff, and every time I would walk in, they'd claim they were looking for recording devices, and then this threat that was issued in December, you know, threatening to throw me into the Oakland County Jail and letting nature take its course and so on and so forth. I mean, it was bizarre. And, you know, since I was doing this sort of freelance, you know, it was very difficult because, you know, I felt like without any editorial support that I needed help from someone. So luckily the Committee to Protect Journalists stepped in, and, you know, they've been very, very helpful, and, you know, always offered me some sort of a hotline number to call if I'd, you know, felt like I was in trouble or in danger or what have you. So at least had that to fall back on. But, you know, long answer to a short question. I was surprised by just the sheer level of it. And not just that, but, you know, sort of how blatant it's been. And I think the problem has been that this court and so many others in Michigan have been operating so almost, They operate autonomously, but they've also operated without any checks and balances at all.
Right.
There have been task force. You know, I don't know if you have been watching the news or reading the news, but, you know, on March 21st, the Attorney General, Dana Nassel, announced an elder abuse task force, which, you know, among its duties would be to look into guardianships and conservatorships. However, two such task forces have been initiated in the past, 1998-2007, as I recall, and nothing really came of them.
Right.
You know, and again, one of the most interesting things about that is that, you know, my team and I met with the Attorney General's staff on March the 12th of this year, and we presented redacted information to them, you know, about a lot of our findings, They wanted to keep it, you know, and said, well, because it's for publication, we're not going to leave it with you, but, you know, we'll show it to you, and we did,
yeah.
A four-hour meeting. And they'd also sent the Supreme Court, the Michigan Supreme Court, a summary of our finding and asked for an interview, and I never got a response back.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I found out about the task force press conference, of course, I, you know, was trying to reach out to the Attorney General's office to RSVP for that and was denied access.
Right.
And asking why, I never got a reason. I guess what they communicated to my then editor was that this was going to be about high-level elder care and that the Oakland County Probate Court was not going to be mentioned. And, I monitored it online and, of course, was very surprised when guardianship and conservatorships were mentioned, but not specifically to the Oakland County Probate Court. Now, had I been there, had I been able to attend, of course, I would have, said something about it and would have
uh-huh.
asked them specifically about crimes to do with that particular probate court and discoveries of such crimes. Indeed, the Michigan Supreme Court communications director, I think his name is John Nevin, told a reporter who was there that they didn't have any, quote, specific instances of wrongdoing. And, I mean, I was flabbergasted. I was like, why don't you have any specific instances of wrongdoing? When, you know, the Attorney General was provided with them, and we also, you know, had sent an overview of our findings to, to Nevin's staff, and never received a response with a request to for an interview. So that was surprising as well. As our investigation has continued, we've dug into the path going back, you know, well over 30 years to an Associated Press report in 1987. Which interviewed a then, now he's actually a shareholder at the law firm of Kemp Clymer, a man by the name of Alan May, who admitted to the Associated Press journalist back in 1987 that he had 400 wards that he didn't visit. And, said he didn't have the time and, you know, it was a profit problem and this, that, and the other. And so, you know, that was 30 years ago. And we've sort of traced everything back and a lot of connective tissue between the judges and the officers of the Oakland County Probate Court and going all the way back to, you know, Mr. May and over 30 years ago. So, you know, and there's also a lot of connective tissue between successive attorneys general. And there's been obviously a reason, and right now with even the current mm-hmm. Attorney General, we're following a fairly solid lead regarding the current Attorney General as well. So it's, you know, there's been a reason why this court has basically had a Teflon suit around it.
Uh-huh.
And where families have, and I feel for them, I really do. I've spoken to so many families in Oakland County. And, you know, one of the most constant complaints that I hear is that they've tried everything. You know, attorneys won't represent them.
Right.
Attorneys tell them either, no, the Oakland County Probate Court, I'm not doing it. And, you know, or they say, yeah, I'll do it, but your retainer is going to be outlandish. And as one attorney explained to me on the record, he said, the reason that the retainer is so high is that if you go up against those judges and the public administrators, you're almost bound to be sanctioned. And
yes.
Those sanctioning costs really add up. So yeah, the retainers are high, and most people don't want to go through it. And they will be put through the ringer as attorneys. So the families don't have any attorneys to turn to. So then, you know, they go through a long list of agencies. They go to local state police posts. They go to the Michigan State Police. They go to the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. They go to Michael Moody. They go
yes.
to the Attorneys General, either, you know, Bill Schuette or Dana Nessel. They go to the State Court Administrator's Office. They go to the Department of Justice. And every single time they're sent packing, or they're told your best option is to get an attorney. So
yes, and you know, Gretchen,
again.
the thing
yeah.
we hear this We hear this constantly, and it goes on, and I've been through the same thing here in Minnesota. You go to the police, they tell you to go to the sheriff tells you to go to the state's attorney general tells you to go to the police, and they just run you around and around and around and around, and
right.
Nobody will do anything. As far as these task force, or my experience with them has been, and I haven't seen this be any different than what I'm about to say, is these are generally constructed and put together to do nothing. It takes them years to come up on the evidence that you've come up on in these last several months. It takes them years to come up with an opinion on what they did find if they looked at anything. And then you always find out that the task force has no regulatory authority, no power over everything. So whatever their findings are just disappears into cyberspace because nobody has the authority to do anything with their information anyway. It's all a front. It's all a like a giant pacifier for the public that, see, we're on it. We've got this task force, which is very carefully populated always with people who will reach the proper conclusion, and that is we hadn't done anything wrong. Or that these things are so minimal, you know, why are you complaining? We did find a few things, but, you know, nothing that would mean we had to get up and do something about it. They will never do the extensive investigation you have done, collect the information you have collected right out of public files. They won't do it. They won't look at it. Go ahead.
Well, the interesting thing about this task force, again, is, you know, the folks that are on it. And there are some good folks. They're folks that won't talk to us. But, you know, I noticed that Moody was on it. I noticed that, you know, the state court administrator's office was on it. But, you know, it's worth pointing out, as far as the state court administrator goes, that, you know, a lot of families, you know, with a lack of any idea of what to do, had been taking their complaint to the Oakland County Board of Commissioners, and they hold monthly meetings, and you know, people are allowed, there's 3 minutes allowed for public comment, and these families would take, you know, they'd line up and do their 3 minutes about the Oakland County Probate Court, and this went on from, you know, July at least when I was there, probably earlier, but from July all the way to October, and finally in October, you know, the Oakland County Board Chair, Mike Ingell, Court Administrator's Office, a note saying, look, you know, we're getting all these complaints about Oakland County Probate. Do you intend to open an investigation? And two weeks later, he got a letter from, you know, State Court Administrator Milton Mack Jr., who was a former Oakland County Probate Court judge in Wayne County. He was a former judge in Wayne County, probate court judge in Wayne County. Anyway, so now he's state court administrator. And he sends this letter back to Jingle saying, look, I got a number of complaints a few months ago. I opened up an investigation. I found nothing wrong with this court. In fact, you should be very, very proud of this court. And he copied that. He copied that letter to the court's chief judge, Kathleen Ryan. And then, you know, the interesting thing about that is that not only we FOIA'd Mac's office and asked him, you know, what were the details of his investigation, how were his conclusions reached, and of course he denied that FOIA request. Meanwhile, one of the judges, Daniel O'Brien, we finally obtained a video of one of the hearings in which, you know, he was clearly upset that people had been going to the Oakland County Board of Commissioners and complaining. And one specific person who'd been going, and he tore her up one side and down the other for going and complaining to the Oakland County Board of Commissioners.
Wow.
You know, when she sort of responded by sort of a silent wave, he threatened to hold her in contempt, and when she left his courtroom, the sheriffs were summoned and she was arrested. So, you know, she's right now facing felony resisting arrest. You know, she's not had an easy time of it. So it's been a tough road for these families. And, you know, one of the most interesting things, you know, at least from, you know, as well as telling their stories, has been the effect of, you know, fighting in this court, which has, you know, as Milton Mack calls it, an excellent reputation. But, you know, the families I've spoken to, they're all, you know, in some way, they all started out having living perfectly happy lives with their moms, their grandmoms, you know, their family
yes.
members. And then, you know, suddenly they're thrown into this tumult, which is, you know, the Oakland County Probate Court, and whether it's been a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you know, the end result is that they're all, you know, they all have some form of PTSD to a person.
Yes.
And that manifests itself in, you know, anger and bitterness and paranoia and sadness and, you know, and you can almost understand it because, you know, every single time they go in, whether they're going in with an attorney or whether they're going in totally pro se because they can't get an attorney to represent them. So, you know, they go in basically unarmed with either, you know, the rules under EPIC or Michigan court rules. But the judges hold them to exactly the same standards as the public administrator. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, so these seasoned lawyers who know these rules and they know exactly what to do with these rules and EPIC, you know, they're at a complete advantage over these families who don't have a clue.
Right.
We have tried to reach out to legal aid organizations across Michigan. And every time we bring up the Oakland County Probate Court, none of them will talk to us. Repeated requests to legal aid organizations, you know, local advocacy organizations, senior advocacy organizations. And again, none of them will respond to us, at least not on the record. So
that's because they're all getting money through funding, Title 20, Social Security, and these block grants. They're all getting money from that. And if they upset the apple cart by saying, you know, this system isn't working and it isn't doing what it's supposed to do, they lose their funding. They're not about to do that. And, you know, that's just one of the things that goes on here. All of this is tied back. A friend of mine suggested to me just today that we need to look at all of this from an economic standpoint. What would it do to the local economy if you stop this process? Because of all the money changing hands, they're not only making money through guardianizing and theft of the estate, you've got doctors making money off of Medicare. I mean, this is a prolific problem. We've got several of them now that have caught diagnosing people with cancer that don't have it so they can make more money. And of course, even if you don't have assets, you can be a cash cow under Medicare. And then, of course, you have hospice,
yes.
which is making money hand over fist, taking people out, getting rid of them when everything else is gone. This extends out into so many areas. That probate judge gets a percentage of the estate. Every time a motion is brought in front of him, he gets, I think in Michigan, it's 4% of the value of the estate at that moment gets paid directly to him. On the East Coast, this is like 2-3%. As you move west to the West Coast, it jumps up to 5 or 6. But see, everybody's making money off of targeting these people. It isn't just the guardian. It isn't just that attorney. That judge is, the social services agencies are, the medical providers are. Everybody's getting a piece of the pie. So what happens, Gretchen? What happens? Cut off the money mill. What happens to just even the local economy? If it was just one person, you'd say nothing. But it is hundreds, if not thousands, of people they're doing this to. So how much money
right.
is actually
and
changing hands?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, Oakland County is certainly one of the richest, in fact, the richest county in Michigan. They like to boast that. Albrooks Patterson has certainly made no secret of that. You know, in terms of, and you're quite right, you know, we spoke to a whistleblower, since, you know, this is supposed to be a whistleblower's program. We did speak to a whistleblower who spoke to us on the record on condition of anonymity, who talked about a pipeline that she has noticed between, because she's a nursing director of various long-term care and rehab facilities for 20 years. And she talked about
uh-huh.
a pipeline between, you know, guardianship and these long-term rehab care facilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she also talks about her own frustrations because, you know, she felt a moral obligation to her patients to care for them as a nurse. But what basically happened is, the Affordable Care Act came in with a readmissions reduction program, I think is what they called it. And basically, if someone was sent back to a hospital from a nursing facility, that hospital would be penalized. And so what they would do is, the NDHHS create a grid for long-term facilities that were sending too many patients back to a hospital. And they would make sure that those long-term facilities didn't get any more patients. So those long-term facilities, she said, were keeping people inside those facilities who should have been in hospitals, and they were dying inside the facilities. Because these facilities were afraid of returning people back to, a hospital when they needed to go back to the hospital. So it sort of led to this big cash cow in terms of facilities, but at the same time, the residents suffered. And one of the other things she noticed was that guardians in her 20 years, she only remembered two guardians that ever showed up to a care conference or ever actually showed up to visit the patient at all. So they weren't actually even fulfilling their duties under EPIC of actually going to see their wards. And we have letters after letter after letter after letter to judges from so many people under guardianship who are writing their judges saying, look, I've had this guardian for 3 weeks, 6 weeks, a year, and I've never seen this person. And whenever I reach out to this person, they don't call back and they don't communicate. What is the ward supposed to do? They get $40 a month, in living expenses. And here's the other thing too, which really surprised us and raised a very big question in our eyes. Under EPIC, a guardian's duty is to restore an individual to a state of, independent living, or a state where they can live independently as quickly as possible. But, we've seen cases dating back, open cases, dating back to as far as 1995. These people have been under guardianship for, decades. But when you look at it and you realize that, within a year, their home's gone, their car's gone. All they have left because of a stand down is basically the Social Security income, which the guardian takes all of outside of $40 per month. Then there's no way they can return to independent living, but because they're completely reliant upon the guardian and the nursing facility. Mm-hmm. So, without a car, without any kind of, way to sort of get to a job interview or anything like that, Michigan's public transportation system is not exactly, it's not like New York or Chicago. I mean, it's not easy to get to a bus around here. So there's no way they can get to a job interview. There's no way they can get independent living. And we've got a couple of cases where, younger wards, and I'm not talking about, elderly people, because there's people from 19 to 98 who've been thrown into guardianship. But younger folks who are able to enter the workforce have been told specifically by their guardians that they can't do it. They're not allowed to go and get a job. Because they don't want them getting a job. They'd rather get the Social Security income.
Right.
So, it seems counterproductive. And, again, when EPIC is saying, get these people to a state of independent living, that the system, the way it's constructed right now, makes that damn near impossible.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it being counterproductive. It was never meant to be productive. This system was set up specifically, if you read the statutes from state to state, they're all virtually the same, but it's nothing but a trap. Once you're in it, there is virtually no way to get out of it. No way whatsoever, because, you said, your assets are gone, your money is gone, you have no way to get anywhere, do anything, and even if someone would take you in, they won't let you go. And to say this is human trafficking is an understatement. It's far more than that. This is actually the profiteering from preying on other people. And I don't know, Gretchen, still after all these years of doing this, have not been able to wrap my head around what happens in someone's mind that they would choose this to make a living, to avail themselves as not only...
That is a,
Yeah. Go ahead.
That is a fantastic question. I mean, you know, as we're sort of closing this out, we were going to reach out to all these individuals, these public administrators, the court itself, the judges, asking them, exactly why and how they have justified some of these actions. I don't expect a response. I certainly didn't get one in the Mimi Brand case, but you never know.
Right.
What's interesting, actually, though, is that, you know, the Michigan Guardianship Association, which, you know, is the local arm of the National Guardianship Association, but, you know, has a lot of these public administrators as members or former members. And after Nestle announced her task force, they went on Michigan Public Radio, one of their spokespeople, and, immediately started saying, well, you know, some of these proposals for guardianship reform are just not fair. Because you have to understand, she was saying, you know, these guardians work for next to nothing. She was making them out to Mother Teresa, and I'm sure some of them are. But, you know, the public administrators we're seeing, the ones that we're looking at, who have, you know, 900, 700, 685, 500 cases each, you know, they're not making next to nothing.
Right.
You know, they're making $83 per ward per month in Medicaid costs. So they're making a tidy sum just in the Medicaid disbursements to them. But the Michigan Guardianship Association is already pushing back on some of the initial reforms that were proposed, saying, you know, that they're not fair. And, you know, it was actually a remarkable interview. For 11 minutes, she's sort of talking about how guardians actually lose money on clients because they she said they're losing money on clients because they have to pay, you know, a parking fee to go into a probate court's parking lot. So there's $30 gone right there. So she's making all these statements that these people are basically doing this out of the kindness of their heart. Again, what she's stating and what the Michigan Guardianship Association is stating and what we're seeing in court documents just really doesn't gel at all.
No.
So one hopes that, you know, they will eventually get back to us. I sent a request for interview to them. And maybe these questions can be put to them. But again, when I spoke to the Michigan Guardianship, the National Guardianship Association back in June of last year for the Brand story, the response I got from them was that I and other members of the media, I'm assuming she's talking about Diane Diamond or, KTNV, Darcy Spears, et cetera, or Dan Roberts, the senior voice, the Vegas senior voice, were cherry-picking cases.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, this wasn't the norm. It was almost the same as the NRA's sort of response, that, you know, we as the media kind of jump on board something that's not the norm.
Yeah.
Just to sell newspapers, but that's, you know, again, that's I push back on that myself. But
about 3 years ago, we had many of us approach Dr. Phil, who I like to lovingly call Dr. Shill, and about guardianship and what he do. Well, they went out and, of course, found one of the most dysfunctional families they could find. These two sisters drug them on TV, and of course, he's cranking them. He's triggering them, and he's pitting them against each other, and they're screaming and hollering, and it the whole thing was a setup. And then at the end of the show, that man had the cojones to stand on that stage in front of that camera and say, and this is why we need professional guardians. After all, there's no profit in it. I almost jumped through the TV, Gretchen.
The thing with this investigation is, you know, I went in, you know, having talked to a lot of these families, you know, fully aware that, you know, I'd rather have just stayed out of those cases that involved family disagreements. I realize that those cases, they do involve, they can end up in a public administrator, but they're very complicated cases. It's you know, from a writer's standpoint, from a journalist standpoint, it increases liability because, of course, you know, you're going to get one side from one side of the family and another side from the other, and that becomes very difficult. So we focus solely, entirely on cases, on petitions that have been filed by outside agencies. That is, Adult Protective Services, social workers from hospitals, we saw cases that have been filed by attorneys from hospitals. We saw cases that have been filed by accounts receivables managers at nursing homes. You know, and those are the cases that we focused entirely upon because we didn't want to sort of get in, you sort of get sort of these family disagreements. Because, yeah, again, we see that again and again in cases at Oakland County where, you know, we've got family members who just can't agree. They're tearing into each other. And the judge obviously says, well, obviously a public administrator is warranted and needed in this case because these families can't agree on anything. And, you know, ultimate, you know, again, I want to be very cautious. I don't want to be, you know, I won't be accused of victim blaming here. But,
right.
You know, really, when you've got two sides of a family that just cannot agree on anything regarding their parents and they've taken it into a probate court, they've immediately clearly painted a target on their backs because the only person that wins out of this is the public administrator.
Yes.
They're the ones that are making back. And in the end, by the time legal fees are done and, you know, the public administrator's hired a lawyer themselves, so that lawyer's getting paid, the public administrator's getting paid, and, you know, by the time it's all said and done, you know, whatever it was they were arguing over in terms of an estate is completely vanished. It's gone. It's disappeared.
Right.
You know, they're lucky to get a coffee mug out of it. And they learn a very harsh lesson. Now, it's, you know, again, one feels nothing but sympathy for them because it's not what they were expecting. It is not how a probate court markets itself. It sort of markets itself as an honest broker. And says, you know, we'll solve your problems. And certainly estate and probate attorneys market themselves that way. But again, you know, these families go in believing, you know, okay, so we can't agree with our sisters or we can't agree with our brothers, so we'll just hire this attorney and we'll sort it all out. But then, you know, the end result of that is that, you know, the only one getting damaged, unfortunately, is the parent.
Right.
You know, and eventually, you know, the arguing siblings end up with nothing. But with this, you know, with these cases where we've looked at APS petitions that have been filed by outside agencies, the court cannot make those arguments. And again, you know, they can't make an argument that a public administrator was necessary, especially in petitions
right.
that we have seen that have been filed with no, you know, really no corroborating medical evidence that an individual ever has dementia. And one of the most interesting things, again, is when these guardian ad litem go in, they're all attorneys. They're not medical professionals. They're not psychological professionals. But they'll go in and they'll ask a ward four questions. What's the date? What's the birthday? Who's the president? And what's your name? And if they can't answer any of those four questions, then boom, you're demented and you need a public administrator and you need to be called legally incapacitated. However, you know, we spoke to a 20-year veteran of geropsychology who said, no, you cannot determine if someone is legally incapacitated by asking four questions. And yet
right.
that is accepted by the Oakland County Probate Court judge as evidence of legal incapacitation just because the guardian ad litem reports, well, they didn't know who the president was. And,
wow.
You know, so we've clearly got an incapacitated person here. And that alone raises questions about the integrity of the process.
Well, it used to be, Gretchen, it was incompetent, but that got questioned so many times, and there again in these probate tribunals, they don't have to follow the rules of evidence, they don't have to follow the Code of Civil Procedure, and so they can, that potential guardian and that attorney representing them can stand up there, and they do levy all kinds of charges that, and many times, as you've pointed out, they've never even seen the person, couldn't point him out in a one-person lineup. But they levy all that they were living in squalor, they were covered in feces, they were starving to death, they blah, 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 blah. And they never are asked for, nor do they ever produce any evidence. And yet the family or the victim itself will try to counter what they have said, and that probate tribunal hearing examiner will not allow that evidence to go into the record, will not hear it, will not allow it to be put on their bench. And then they write up the file as if no one objected. And this goes on every day. This is by definition a kangaroo court. Everything is planned before you get in there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I've seen many a motion day where, you know, that kind of procedure has happened. And it is assumption, you know, that constitutional rights, civil rights, statutory rights are just basically thrown out of the window under the banner of protection.
Yes.
You know, judicial discretion, you know, under protection allows judges to do that, or the judges feel that they're allowed to do that. And funny that you should mention that we've gone from incompetent to incapacitated. You know, back in the 13th century, where this law really originated, was Henry III, who, you know, added a dictum, I think it was like 1272, in which the estates of what he called lunatics and idiots should be turned over to, you know, the royal court. And the basis of that decree, what was exported over to pre-revolutionary America eventually, has not changed. It's like a lot of, you know, British laws that were exported over, you know, to, you know, former British colonies. That, you know, even when those colonies gained independence, the laws themselves really didn't change that much. You know, for example, we see it a lot of, in, you know, those former British colonies that still have sodomy laws on the books, and still mete out punishments for, you know, lesbian, gay individuals that engage in, you know, as you know, you've seen the news lately about stoning under Sharia law. But some of the other other countries rather that, you know, have stuck to, you know, British colonial law regarding sodomy, have kept those laws on the books, and a lot of the times the punishments have remained the same. Now, what's interesting about guardianship is that the basis, the actual sort of, you know, the fundamental principles, the underlying principles that were determined by, you know, Henry III, who was not, you know, like many British monarchs, was not the most rational of people, have basically remained unchanged. And, you know, the historians have talked a lot about, you know, what it was like back then, talked about inquisitions that were held for people, for lunatics and idiots, to be placed under, you know, to have their estates placed under the king's rule. And those inquisitions, the way he was put it, they were inquisitions. And again, when you kind of look at it in a modern day perspective, the idea of it being an inquisition really, to me, doesn't seem to have changed that much. Because, again, you know, there doesn't seem to be much in the way of due process that you would expect in, say, a criminal court. Those rights don't exist in a probate court.
No. No. And the thing is, Gretchen, all of the statutes in every state say that, you know, due process will be provided, but there is no penalty for not providing it, and there's no enforcement of this penalty should you decide to. So they can get away with not abiding by due process. And this is what happens. They have these ex parte hearings, and this, when you talked about people having PTSD from being in this system. And it comes from, I always say, the first assault is when they step into that first probate tribunal. And they think they know what the law is. They think they know what their rights are. And in a, you know, better world, they would be. But they walk in there and they are hit with this wall of corruption and this whole system that is set against them. And the knowledge, the immediate knowledge that everything was decided before they ever walked in the room, they never had a chance. And I have seen and listened to and talked to more people who this just shattered everything they thought about who we are as a country, what we stood for, how great our justice system was, just literally in shock over it, that this was going on in this country of all places. And I feel bad for them because it's I've seen families torn apart. I've marriages dissolved. People have borrowed against their homes two and three times, spent their kids' college funds trying to save mom, dad, or their wife or husband, someone from this system. And there just is no relief. There is no way of getting out. It is in and of itself a prison. And it doesn't just affect the person they targeted. The whole family is imprisoned.
And you know, I have to, you know, as I sort of look back and I'm closing things out and getting ready to, you know, head back to Chicago. You know, one of the things that I will miss most, you know, about Michigan you know, the investigation was tough. But it's certainly, you know, the family members that I met are the bravest of people.
Right.
You know, they spoke to us on the record. You know, out of all the families we spoke to, there was only one family that requested, you know, an alias be used because the case
mm-hmm.
was still in litigation and they feared retaliation. But the others, you know, they took, you know, they're taking a great chance because, you know, I get
yes.
to go back to Illinois into relative safety. I mean,
mm-hmm.
these folks have to stay in Michigan. And they are, you know, they're out there. They're out at commissioners' meetings. They're out protesting. They're out, you know, waving their signs and saying this has to change. They're talking to people like me, and they're talking openly. You know, even though the shadow of retaliation against them is always, it's always going to be a constant shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, they've been braver. You know, I have gone down the list of estate and probate attorneys, which is the largest section of the Michigan Bar, of the State Bar of Michigan. And only two out of hundreds would talk to me about the Oakland County Probate Court. Only two
oh, wow.
had the courage. Only two.
Wow.
And one of them requested anonymity. So, you know, I had one attorney who went on the record with his full name, and he's retired, so he doesn't, I don't think he really minds. But the others, absolutely not. And I would argue that these families have more at stake, especially when they have wards who are presently in guardianship and therefore, you know, could be endangered by any kind
mm-hmm.
of retaliation, you know, who have shown more bravery than even, you know, members of the Michigan legal profession, which actually stunned me. And,
yeah.
You know, when, in sort of looking back, I stand by this, that these folks in their own ways are very much heroes because they, you know, they fight for what is right.
Yes.
They fight for their parents. They fight for, but even, you know, when their parents have passed away under guardianship, they'll stay fighting because as one family member told me, you know, I'm doing this. And she lost her father,
uh-huh.
who was a World War II veteran. And he had a, you know, well over $100,000 when he was under guardianship at the Oakland County Probate Court. Within 1 year, that money was gone. And by the time he died, he had about $100 in his account. And that was only after two years of guardianship. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this guy died alone in a hospital room covered with scabies mites. And, you know, I spoke to his daughter and she said, you know what, I thought about being anonymous, but she said, you know what, no, I'm not going to. My dad wouldn't want me to be anonymous. I'm not going to be anonymous. I'm going to tell his story. And I'm going to say it, and I'm going to tell that story so that other families don't have to go through this. And every other family that I've spoken with has been the same way. We want to tell this story so that other families don't have to go through this. We don't want other families to go through this. That doesn't seem to have been the feeling on the part of members of the Michigan legal profession. Who would
no.
think, you know, bound by yeah. their oath and bound by their own code of ethics, would be the first to want to step up and say this needs to change.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, they feel like their, you know, their licenses might be in danger, their livelihoods or what have you, and so they won't. And you know, but I would argue that these families have a lot more to lose, and have lost a lot. So they are the people that I will take back with me, and you know, long after this investigation is done and published, and you know, it's you know, we're on to the next thing in the news or
yes.
what have you. You know, I will take those individuals with me for the rest of my life.
It is I know what you're talking about. Over the years, the people I have talked with and the families, you know, just people sitting on the phone crying and just sobbing, feeling powerless, and basically they are, and needing just some kind of hope somewhere, and don't see any. You talk about these attorneys, Lisa Belanger, a good friend of mine out in Boston, an appellate attorney. Her father, this has been all over the social networking, and was guardianized here 7 years ago. He just passed away here a few weeks back. He had been held prisoner in his own home for all those years, drugged against his will, and she fought them tooth and nail over her dad, and even went in front of the Michigan Supreme Court trying to get her father extricated from this guardianship. And the guardian stood there and said, "Judge, she's costing the estate money." She said, and she said, "I'm not getting any money." She said, "That's all you want is the effing money. Keep it." She said, "Give me back my father." They would not let that man go. And they have launched an investigation against her, Gretchen. She filed two RICO cases against them, taken right out of public records, showing clear collusion and conspiracy to defraud, took it right out of public records. And they wouldn't even acknowledge that what she filed was RICO, and now they're doing an investigation on her with the intent of either suspending her for 2 years or disbarring her for daring to out these other attorneys. And this is what they do. Yep. They will tear you up. They'll go after them, ruin their practice, ruin their name, plant false stories about them all over the net.
I understand that. I do. And I understand that attorneys have, you know, have a livelihood.
Right.
You know, and what they call a trial-like proceeding in front of the Michigan Attorney Discipline Board is not a fun process.
Right.
But, you know, in Chicago, I have known many an idealistic attorney who has taken on ICE, or, you know, the attorneys of the Immigrant Coalition that do a lot of their work for free. I know so many attorneys that just do pro bono work, or, you know, or at the same time, they take on fairly heavy powered institutions. And, you know, they're not afraid of doing it. They're not afraid of taking on other attorneys. You know, that's part of their job. And as the one attorney that spoke to me off the, you know, on the record, but as anonymously, he just said, you know, I keep going in. I get sanctioned. I get sanctioned and I get sanctioned. But he said, you know, every time that happens, I look back on the oath that I took and, you know, on the families that I'm representing who, you know, and I say, well, that's part of my oath. I am fulfilling my oath, and if what has happened to them is unjust and wrong, it is my duty to go ahead and represent them to the best of my ability and to point out those flaws, whether families are suffering, whether it's, you know, even if it is against the public administration and the judge themselves, and they're sanctioning me for it. But he says, I can't ignore my oath. Now, you know, where his compatriots are, where that idealism is within the Michigan legal community, I don't know. I really don't, because I have asked and asked, and you know, again, no response. It just seems like it could be so simply done. You know, if people just, you know, people who are attorneys who have fee licenses would step forward and say, look, this, and you might be putting your license on the line. But, you know, in the end, you've got to ask yourself, I suppose, you've got to ask yourself what's right. You know, when I set out on this investigation, I mean, you know, everyone in the journalistic profession was telling me, don't do it. You know, I mean, you're going to lose everything. And, you know, what are you going to end up with? I mean, you're going to end up with a piece that probably no one's going to run because no one wants to read about the elderly. And, you know, but I said, no, to hell with that. I'll go it. I'll do it because, you know, this is a story and it needs pursuing. And, you know, I mean, 8 months later and, you know, who knows? Who knows what's going to come of this story? You know, if it's going to get buried or this, that, and the other. I mean, you just never know. But I honestly believe that it's been worth it, every second of it.
Yeah.
Because,
well,
you know, without
it's probably the first time we've had an in-depth and honest investigation of this. I mean, we've had people touch on it. I've written on it. I don't have your expertise in it. But what I'm saying is to do an actual expose, which is what this is, and to look at one area.
You know,
go ahead.
In all fairness, you know, people like Diane Diamond have done their work as well, and very, very well. And I can't ever underestimate, you know, the work of Tim in Las Vegas, and, you know, Dan Roberts, who ran this tiny little senior newspaper out there, you know, who jumped on board with a, you know, Darcy Spears over at KTNV, and they really sort of blew this open.
Well,
again,
Steve Miller out there too in Las Vegas. Steve Miller's hammered on this for 20 years, and done everything he could, you know. But go ahead.
Yeah, but so you know, I'm very proud to be one of the few journalists who have felt like compelled enough to take this on, you know, and take on a very, very difficult issue that the publishers, quite frankly, are very reticent to take on. I've had a devil of a time finding a publisher for this piece because they all look at it and they go, oh, no, you're accusing judges, you're accusing attorneys. That's a liability. You know, but at the same time, you know, the folks that do believe in it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's important work, and it has to be done because, unfortunately, you know, I look at it a lot, you know, like the Catholic priest abuse scandal. I know that's sort of apples to oranges in many ways, but there are some similarities in terms of the way that the victims were marginalized before the Boston Globe article came out in 2002. You know, it was very marginalized, small groups, never believed, almost thought of as conspiracy theorists, have, you know, very, very damaged people in the same, different ways, but damaged all the same. Such a very, very long time, and it's still not resolved.
Right.
You know, but at least now people are standing up and paying attention and saying, you know, that what you were saying prior to 2002, well, we believe you now. You know, but, you know, what's happening within, you know, what I see within those people who are fighting Guardians on a national level or a local level is that same sort of marginalization. That, you know, these victims are just conspiracy theorists and, you know, they're making up stuff that couldn't possibly be true. And, you know, America kind of wants to turn its face on this and sort of say, now it isn't happening. And besides, it happens to the elderly. Who cares? And, you know, and that has to change. And I think, you know, with enough people getting behind it, and I think with enough journalists who are prepared to follow the lead of Ms. Diamond and Ms. Spears and all the other local journalists that have jumped on board this, that will change eventually.
And
people will start to pay attention because, you know, to not do so seems incredibly short-sighted because we're all getting older. I mean, I'm sort of looking without trying to age myself too much. You know, I'm 2 years before I get my first AARP magazine through the mail. And it's sort of living in, you know, being in Michigan for the 8 months I've been here, it's like, well, blimey, you know, I'm almost relieved to be getting out. Because, you know, what, 2 years, what, do I have a target on my back? You know, the crime of getting old, and everyone's going to get that. That's the thing.
Yes.
And if you don't do something about a system where you can be thrown in for falling down in the parking lot of Costco, you know, if you don't do something about a system where you are virtually imprisoned for slipping in a parking lot because, you know, you're elderly and you have a home and you have something that's worth taking, then, you know, I mean, you might as well just sort of say, okay, well, I'm just going to roll the dice and hope it doesn't happen to me. But then it does,
Gretchen,
you know, to someone or to someone they know.
We're down to the last minute here, so I want to thank you for coming on, especially on such short notice. I truly appreciate it, and I appreciate the work you have done on this. I can't wait to read your work. Whenever you get it out there, however you get it out there, you let us know. We'll help promote it. We'll do everything we can to back you up. Again, thank you for coming on. Our guest tonight has been Gretchen Rachel Hammond, and she has been investigating and reporting on the corruption in the probate out in Michigan, and this is going to be quite an expose when it comes out. I want to remind everybody about the Whistleblower Summit taking place this year, July 29th, 30th, and 31st in Washington, D.C. We'll all be out there. I hope to see you there, too. It's open to the public, so please, if you can attend, do. Gretchen, again, thank you. And everybody who tuned in tonight, we had a huge audience, I can see. Thank you for tuning in and listening and supporting these shows. We do appreciate it. And with that, we'll say good night. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.